So, but that's on you guys. I'm still Tommy T, and I'm an alcoholic. So, let's pick a prayer. Okay, this prayer was written by an overeating rabbi in another fellowship. That's not funny. Everybody's got issues. His name is Rami Shapiro. I was turned on to it by Bob B. I think this prayer just sums up us in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it says, "My God, the soul you have placed in me is pure. I am free to live differently than yesterday. Because it is pure, I am free to live without the burden of past habits, past fears, past mistakes, and past failures. I am free to look at my past without repeating it, to examine for it lessons to be learned and amends to be made, to draw from it what guidance I can to live differently today. My God, may I use today's gift of freedom to further my capacity to serve you by serving your children with justice, compassion, and humility." Awesome stuff. So now let's talk about sex. I'll tell you, looking at you guys from this angle, I would say most of you need an overhauling there. We got the strict Peppa diet over here. We got the guys, well, maybe some of them are having it, but it's not the right kind. You know, I think we got all those pages of on page 69. Bill had a sense of humor that he claims to be. But we got a few older guys in here. The 60s, the 70s, and the 80s were not mental health and sexual well-being eras, in my opinion. It was a freak show out there. And we come up again with those false fixed ideas based on probably what we learned as kids or didn't learn as kids, what we saw in our homes, and things like that. And how do you get through that? You know, I often talk about Alcoholics Anonymous as an unfair advantage because I know of no religion, I know of no self-help program or psychotherapy or anything, or any type of change agent that promises us a spiritual experience that is sufficient to overcome alcoholism. But then there's that little extra promise in the big book. It will solve all your problems. Now, when you take your second step and you say, God is everything or God is nothing, what's my choice to be? We say, God is everything. God's your sex? Pray before you jerk off next time. See how that goes. When my sponsor told me, bring God into your porn use, I was like, I don't know about that. Can I just close the door and talk to him later and repent? I got a lot of issues. Always had them. Didn't understand the way my father dominated my mother and all. And I don't want to make this all about my dad today or this weekend, but you know, what I saw is what I saw. No. What I didn't see is the horrendous way I've always treated women. That was that first fourth step. 23 substantial relationships on that first fourth step. And, you know, I was just talking to somebody, and Bob B., I think, just really nails that first fourth step. You know, we think it's the greatest literature work in history when we do it. It's really in sobriety and getting down to all the causes and conditions. It's really like finger painting in kindergarten, like bring it home, put it on the refrigerator, but nobody's looking at it in a couple of years, you know. But when I wrote that, and I thought these women were crazy and that like I wasn't that bad of a guy, that's really how I went into that inventory. And then I saw, oh my God, how did these women possibly stay with me as long as they did? And I started to see me for the person that I was. I thought it was just insurmountable. How are you going to possibly turn that around? Can't be done. You know, I'm a real charmer. I'm a good first three or four dates. I'll treat you real nice. I'll tell you all the things you want to hear. I'll listen to you, or I'll make it look like I'm listening to you. I still got issues with that. But I'll do all those things. I'll open the door. I'll pay the check. I'll be kind. I'll be loving, unless I don't get what I want. And then I'll be mean and egotistical and do the things that I think might get me there. I can be bullying. I can be intimidating. I can be all those things I don't want to be. But if I'm not getting my way, see, I'm a child first. And that's how I come into a relationship. But if you're doing good, in my eyes, I'll treat you well. And I can tell you, like, oh, you know, all I want is some adult company. I'm not looking to get into a relationship. Women and men are different, fellas. They're going to fall in love with you if you treat them nice. It's just the way it goes. And then I get scared, and I push you away. I pushed every one of those 23 women away. And if you won't leave when I'm doing it nicely, I'll get real mean about it. I'll just treat you like garbage until you have to leave me. It's a self-protection thing. And I saw it over and over and over again. It wasn't my resentments with my father, my mother, or my childhood. It wasn't my fears that when I looked at. When I looked at that relationship inventory the first time, before reading it to my sponsor, I cried because I didn't like what I saw. Even back then, in that self-loathing state of 18 months sober, 36 years old, just lost, I didn't like what I saw at all. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I give my life to God in service of others. And I'm killing it for those first few years. I'm killing it, fellas. I'm self-proclaimed, I'm killing it. You know, I'm helping as many guys as I can. I'm working with 6-8 guys at a time, newcomers. I got a group that I meet with on Wednesday night. I'm the GSR at the home group, and I'm cruising along. Maybe 3 years sober, I meet this girl, and we start talking. Oh, the spiritual discoveries we were having. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. You know, we just had this wonderful relationship, and we started to talk about having children. You know, I was talking to a young man last night that's getting ready to meet his son or his daughter for the first time. I met my son, Brett, at when he was 9, and I was 3 years sober. And I said, well, my son's in my life now. There can't be any unwanted pregnancies, and this and that. If we're going to have children, we have to get married. So, you know, after a very long relationship of about 5 months, we decide to get married. I don't know anything about this girl. I didn't know she was bipolar. I didn't know she was 5 years older than she said she was. That don't matter to me, but, you know. But I didn't realize she couldn't have children physically. But we were getting married to have babies. And that's how I went into that marriage, sober. Everybody in my home group said, what are you doing? I'm doing the right thing is what I'm doing. You don't understand. Well, she accused me of cheating on her on the honeymoon. She stopped taking her medication. There was an actual physical change in her. You could see when she was off her medication. It went south really quick. She had a mental breakdown in that first year, and I'm sponsored by Joe at this point. And Joe said, Tommy, we talked about this. You went through with it. You cannot run out on this. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, start visiting her in the psych ward. I said, oh, come on. What, are you kidding me? I'm ready to just jump out, as I always do. And he said, you need to do everything in your power to save this marriage and be a service to her, or else your whole program is full of garbage. So we tried 3 different counselors. She accused me of having affairs with 2 of them. One was a guy. I thought that was pretty funny. I said, that's in my past, babe. But we went through that, and when she got well enough, we both agreed that we rushed into it, and we got a very, very amicable divorce. You know, she was making more money than me. We're friends today, to this day. But then I come up on about 6 years sober, and I don't want to date in AA, so I find this thing called Match.com. Now, some giggled, so some of you guys know it. You know, if you're 40 years old and you have pretty much a full set of teeth, a little hair, and coverage, you're a home run on Match.com. So I go into starting to date 3 girls named Lisa at the same time. Again, doing all the commitments at the home group, doing all the AA activities, and I'm having a conversation with these girls to saying that, you know, I take care of my sick mother. I'm raising a boy on my own. He's now moved in with me because at 12 years old, Brett got so out of hand that his mother couldn't handle him anymore. He moved in with me. And I'm telling him this, so really, I have 1-2 days a week tops for any relationship. What I didn't realize, these women were all recently divorced. They went on Match.com like all us losers do. And we were just looking to hook up. But women and men are different. Sex to men, it's really no big deal. I mean, if you're like me, it's just what we do. Love and intimacy, a whole different thing. Women will fall in love with men. Men can just say it's good sex. And, you know, if it's not great sex the first time, I'll give you a couple more auditions. But you got to come around to my way of seeing things eventually, you know. And so I'm dating these three girls named Lisa. And all of a sudden, pornography starts drifting back into my life. My son starts doing drugs, and I'm out of my mind with that. And I prayed 2 hours one time driving home from work and to be a better father and to listen to him and not worry about the watch he just stole and hocked on me and all this stuff. And I see him coming out of my house with three of his friends with some of my personal possessions. They were just coming in to get showered and then go back out on another run. And I screeched to a stop in the middle of my block. It was a Friday afternoon. I jumped out of my car in a suit and tie, after praying for 2 hours. I said, what are you doing? He says, what, Dad? And he sees me coming at him, and I guess I was coming at him in a threatening way. He started to run. I used to play football. I was a linebacker. I took him out on my front lawn with a really good shoulder tackle. And I punched that kid in the head as hard as I could. All of a sudden, lawnmowers start going off in the neighborhood. People are out there doing their lawns. They're looking at me like, oh, my God, he must be drinking again. I'm sober 7 years. I just prayed for 2 hours. This is the best I got. But the sexual behavior got worse and worse. I started to see the technology, what the technology could do for us with screenshots and all that stuff and chats. And, oh, my God, I was in heaven. But I'm not telling anybody about this. And, you know, if you're a deviant like me, you can't enjoy that deviancy when you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you can't enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous because you know you're a deviant. You can't do the things that I was doing at home, go into home group and be the greeter. Oh. Just doesn't work. So you put yourself in this, like, sexually kind of purgatory place. You can't enjoy the spirit because you got this deviant side. And you can't fully enjoy the deviant because you know it's wrong. It's a tough spot to put yourself. So I'm going through like that. Then my parents die. Tough time. 7 to 10 years for you new guys. Hang on. A lot of fun, that second surrender. But it gets to us a place to look deeper. And that's, I hope, a message that a lot of guys here see this weekend is there's always a deeper place to go. There's always more work to be done. And thank God there is. Because what I've done over the years would not keep me sober today. I have to become a better man, somehow, some way. I don't know what that looks like, but somehow my sponsor does. Somehow the guys that are down the roads further than me, they do know what you have to do, and they have valuable suggestions if you're willing to listen to it. First of all, you have to be willing to ask for it. You have to be willing to tell them the truth of your behaviors, which is not really. When I sat with Joe with 10 years of sobriety and my parents were dying, and I started to tell him all the things I was doing, this man's face just went. I had no idea. Yeah, I know, Joe, I'm a really good liar. I'm really sorry about that. I'm not going to let it happen again if I can help it. He said, well, that's a start. That's a start. He said, I don't want you in any relationships for a while. You got to get back on the beam here. You've been off it for a long time. And I feel bad as a sponsor not knowing that you were off it so long. I said, I'll be more honest, Joe. Whatever's going on in my life, I'll tell you. And I was broken enough to mean it. No, better than that, I was broken enough to start doing it. Joe knew everything. My inventory started to change. My nightly reviews, they weren't general. They weren't slanted my way or anything. This is what happened. This is how I acted. I know I need to clean it up. I'm going to do that tomorrow. That's what it became. And I'm going along, and all of a sudden, I'm at my home group on Monday night. And this girl walks in, and she's new. She's got nice tight jeans on, ripped up, you know, cowgirl boots on. Nice little outfit, blonde hair. She's loud. She looks crazy. I said, oh, there's my girl over there, you know. But I said, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. Then I find out she's got 3 kids. She's got 35 days. I'm like, no, come on. You can't. You're going to have to tell Joe. That's, you know, it's more of the fear of being judged by my sponsor than anything. But I said, no, hands off. But God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Cheryl ended up going across town a little bit with a group and got into a big book study. And I didn't see her on Monday nights. The big book study met on Monday nights. So I didn't see her around AA. And she went through and had a bond-burning experience with our 12 steps. When I met her again, she had probably about 6 months, something like that. And we knew the same type of friends. So we had a great group of like 40-somethings that would go out. We'd even go to bars sometimes to listen to a good band, have a nice meal, maybe catch a movie, do this. But there was like 12, 13, 14 of us. It was a great little fellowship group of folks. And there was no flirting. There was no nothing going on. But I started to get to know her. I heard about the trouble with her children, trouble with her ex-husbands, all these things. And we gradually became friends. And we're out in a place in New Jersey. It's a real meat rack, you know. It's where all the singles go to meet, and it's down in Red Bank. I forget the name of the place, but Bonacera was the name of the place. You'd go there, you'd have a beautiful dinner. They'd pull the tables aside, and then it would be all these 40, 50-year-olds. It was pathetic, you know, it was just a pickup joint, right? And, I mean, the pickup line was, are you married? You know, that was the pickup line for the girls, you know. It was bad. You had the guy with the white suit and the white vest on doing the moves. It was really a freak show. And we're dancing in there. And a girl comes over and she actually said that, are you married? And started dancing with me. And Cheryl all of a sudden gets all jealous. And she comes over and kind of like hip checks her on the dance floor. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting, right? And I got Joe in the back of my head, you know. Don't do it, Tom. So I said, all right. I'm going to do something a little different now. I noticed there was a little spark between me and Cheryl at this point. And I went to Joe. And I said, Joe, I think I'm starting to have some feelings for this girl. How long is she sober now? I said, about 9-10 months. You know, but we've been friends for a while. He said, you're not putting your hands on that girl until you can come back to me and tell me that you will take responsibility for her 3 children as they were your own. That's a little harsh, Joe. Quiet-spoken man, he said, you tell me. I'm not going to sit by and willingly know that you're out there hurting another woman and children as well. You're not that guy anymore. You're not allowed to be that guy anymore and be sponsored by me. I've never been spoken to as a sponsor like that in my life. He got my attention. And I said, okay, Joe. I stayed away from Cheryl a little bit. Went out with that group, did things like that. And then one day, we were going out with 6 people to see a movie, and the other 4 canceled. And Cheryl called and said, do you still want to go? I said, yeah, I want to go. It's my only night off this week. I was working 12 days on, 2 days off. And I said, I'll pick you up. And we went out. We went out to the diner afterwards. We were there until 3 o'clock in the morning. We talked about everything under the sun. And she will tell you, I told him things that night I still wish I didn't tell him. Because we started to feel the connection. And there was no sex, fellas. There was no sex. There was a lot of bumping and grinding. There was a lot of flirting. There was a lot of sexual tension where one of us left. Like, I got to go. You know, I got to go. If I stay, it's going to happen. I got to go. You know. And we courted until she had about 14 months. So we did that for about 6 months. It was magical. It was wonderful. I never thought I'd feel something like that. So at 47 years old, fellas, 47, I made love to the first woman in my life because all the others were just sex. I would hope I liked them afterwards, but I loved Cheryl before we ever hit the sheets. It was great. It was special. And I got to tell you, I'm here to tell you that 18 years later, it's still just as special. I would have never got that without a sponsor. I would have never found that. See, women were a conquest to me. They were a notch on my belt. I hate to say this, but it's easy in a men's retreat. But, you know, it's just the better they looked, the better I felt about myself. It's like a piece of jewelry. It's a horrible thing to say. Cheryl's my best friend. She's got my back. Oh, if you guys, one of you guys wanted to come after me, you'd have to go through her first. She's a tough Irish girl. You know? God does for us here what we can't do for ourselves. Because I'll tell you, fellas, never did I say one prayer that says, oh, dear Lord, please send me an alcoholic Irish woman with an attitude and three children. Just never happened. Just never happened. And then he sends me my best friend. And then he teaches a guy like me what it is to be intimate with a woman, to be friends with a woman. You know how bad I am in relationships, fellas? A couple of years into that relationship, I'm talking to my sponsor about, I don't know what it is, sponsor. I can listen to a newcomer for an hour and a half outside a home group, and I know I got to go to work the next day, and I'm tired, but I'll listen to that guy who's struggling. But I go home, and I ask my wife, how was your day, honey? And 2 minutes in, I'm looking over her shoulder at the TV. I can't wait to get out of that conversation. I said, sponsor, she wants to hold hands. What am I going to do? This is crazy. He looks at me like, hold her hand. It's not that hard, Tom. No, come on, we're watching a movie, she wants to snuggle. It's not all about sex, Tom. Hold your wife, well, she wasn't my wife yet, hold your girlfriend. The simple things that maybe a normal man feels, I don't feel. I think that's like spiritual work to hold my wife's hand. Not only that, I want credit for when I do it. Being a man is not easy for me, fellas. That's why I need you guys. I need a Joe in my life. I need multiple Joes in my life. I just had a sponsee the other day tell me, I'm not that touchy-feely guy. I said, stop. Change the narrative a little bit. You choose not to be that touchy-feely guy. What you're not changing, you're choosing. That's just the way that goes. We can be taught to be more kind and loving. We could be taught to. So my sponsor, Joe, Cheryl goes, we end up going through, we have a wonderful courtship, we move in together. I think I'm doing everything right. I even made her a domestic partner so she could have my health insurance. How much more committed can a guy get? I'm hoping you're laughing because you're agreeing with me. I am totally monogamous. I'm not looking at other people. I introduce her as my fiance. I'm just doing everything. I think I'm doing perfect right now. We're building this family together. My son's coming out of rehab, and he's living with us. The other three are living with us. We have a good blended family. Crazy house, but great place, full of love. Same house I grew up in. I bought my parents' house. Alcoholics Anonymous, God, Cheryl and her kids has healed that house. It's a place of love. It's a place you'd want to hang out now. It wasn't that way. But we go along with that for a while. And all of a sudden, Cheryl's like, I told you I don't want to be a girlfriend forever. I said, you're not. You're my domestic partner. Yeah, ooh, ooh. It doesn't sound like ooh until I say it. And then it's like, give me that back. Yeah, I know. It seems it's kind of embarrassing, but, you know. So I can't get Joe on the phone, so I call Bob B., a man who loves me enough to tell me the truth. And I said, Bob, I think she's leaving. He says, why? We were just together a couple weeks ago. You guys are doing great. I said, I thought so, too. But she put the ultimatum out there for marriage, and he's like, and? What's your fear? I said, what do you mean what my fear is? I'm a two-time loser already, and so is she. I don't want to enter into a marriage and then hurt the kids. The kids you're worried about? Is that what you're going to try to tell me? All of a sudden, Bob was not that sweet old guy anymore. And then he went on to say, if you don't marry that girl, Tom, I'm going to jump on a plane and come over there and slap you because something needs to change here. You guys are great together. I see the way you look at each other. What are you doing? You'll regret this the rest of your life if you let this girl go. Jesus Christ. I hang up the phone. I'm shaking my head because I know he's right. I'm just afraid. I'm afraid I'm going to fail again, as I always do. Now I start thinking that the things I've done for the last couple of years, I'm just faking it because it didn't come easy for me. Things don't come easy for me, fellas. The things that a normal man would do, just fall in love, know what's right, and do the right thing, doesn't happen for me. There's too many thoughts and too many conversations going on in my head to make anything an easy decision. But Christmas came. I saved up for a ring, and I put it in the bottom of a stocking. And the whole family was there. And Bob went on to tell me, you can't see that woman who's been married twice because of pregnancies, that just she just wants to have a man ask her for a hand in marriage because he loves her. How blind are you, Tom? Come on, man. You look at yourself. Look at this. It made perfect sense. So I put that ring down at the bottom of the thing. We do our presents, and then we do the stockings. And this was the last thing in her stocking. And she pulled it out and said, what's this? I said, open it up. You know, our boy AJ was 8 years old at that time. Great kid. He's a once born. He's not like us, you know. And he just thinks everything's wonderful and everybody loves him. You know. And she takes it out and she just gets all teary-eyed. And I take the ring from her and I get on my knees. And I tell her, you're my best friend. I'm so glad that God sent you to me. Will you spend the rest of your life with me and marry me? And she starts breaking down crying. We hugged. It was a beautiful moment. I sit on the couch with AJ and he said, that was pathetic, bro. It was just the best. But what you don't know, fellas, is those kids seeing a man do that, they're going to remember that. They're going to remember that. And it was heartfelt. There was no fake in there. I wasn't forced to do it. That came from the heart. I didn't prepare anything to do with her or anything. And we have had a wonderful, wonderful marriage since. We ended up getting married at the 2015 International the day before because all our friends were coming in on the Wednesday. We said, hey, are you willing to come in on Tuesday? And we're going to have a dinner up at the Hilton and, you know, this. And so we had like a AA wedding. And Bob B stood up for me and Polly Pistol stood up for Cheryl and Dave Pistol married us. I mean, and the third step was in our wedding vows. It was just awesome. And then the joke was, we went right down to the opening ceremonies, so like World Services threw our reception for us, you know, with 65,000 of our best friends. And like recovery, I love that girl more today than I ever have. We travel together, we do everything together, she's my ride and die. It's just awesome. And it's wearing off on our kids. They see all the people that we work with, they see us pray with our friends. They see us be honest when it's uncomfortable to be honest. They see mom coming to me. And you know now, fellas, tie it into the daddy stuff and all that. The kids come to me to talk. Because mom's a fixer. Mom can't help it. She's just a mom. You know, she hears a problem with a daughter or a son. She wants to fix it. This is what we have to do. This is what you need to do. And I talk to them like newcomers. Well, how'd that work out? What other options do you think you had? You want any advice on it? I've been through a similar situation. They feel comfortable with me. I'm no longer a deadbeat dad. I show up for my kids. I'm always there for my kids. I'll run for my kids. And you know what? Those three kids are my kids. The middle boy who just bought the house, he's really closed-mouthed and closed down. We've been having the most wonderful conversations over the last few months. My birthday was Wednesday. I flew out here on my birthday. And I got a card that I couldn't even read. It started with, you're the best dad ever. The best dad a guy could ever ask for. Like, I went into that because of the love I had for Cheryl. And now that transferred over to the kids. God's got a plan for each and every one of us, and it might not happen in our time frame. You don't know how you're going to start getting healed here. But like I said in an earlier talk, it's starting to happen for me. I don't think I'm faking this anymore. It comes from my heart. I come here with nothing prepared for you guys or anything. This is just what it is. I'm starting to become a good man because of you guys, because of God. Sex is sex, fellas. But when you find your best friend and you get in that relationship, it's awesome. It is awesome. And you get to see friends that are experiencing it too when they know, they nod when they see you. Yeah, you got one too, huh? It's pretty good. And then when they get together and they start talking, you just sit back and say, how the F does this happen? Especially in California. So far away from home, you know. But it's wonderful, fellas. So, you know, whatever you're going through in your relationships or, you know, hopefully not, but, you know, possibly your porn life or whatever's going on there, you're holding yourself back. You're shortchanging yourself. It's not the physical relief. That has nothing to do with it. When you can really talk about anything you want with your partner, when you can let them see you're afraid, when you can tell them, I'm sorry, babe, I acted like an asshole, but it was because I was afraid. And they're like, I know you're an asshole, but that's why I love you. It's the coolest thing ever. So that's what I got on that.
All right, buddy, Jimmy Alcoholic. You know, I met Tommy about 15 years ago, and I always wondered why he wore rubber gloves when I went into his home group. That's kind of weird. And just to correct him, the name of that restaurant's Buena Sara, not Bona Sara. So, and one more thing, I just got to say this because I haven't said it yet, you know, and he thought I was going to say it. If I just kind of space out up here, and you know I'm lost for words because that could happen up here to anyone, you know. Just yell out airplane, because I'll tell you the story of how I saved his life on an airplane the other day as he had a full-blown stress attack or something. So that's a little inside joke. And I'll tell you, you know, my wife, Mary Beth, and Cheryl, very close friends, they're sponsored by the same woman, Mari Gallagher. You guys all know, a lot of you guys know Mari, and thank God for her that she nurtures and takes care of them and gets them in the right direction. But just to have a friend like Tommy and like you guys have friends and wives that are in recovery and to be able to go places and do things together like we do and just have a lot of fun, that wasn't my story for a long time either. You know, I remember writing inventory the first time I wrote a sex inventory, you know, and I wasn't talking about one-night stands, like my first girlfriend to my ex-wife. If you put the if you covered the names on that thing, it was the same Jimmy right across the board. It was shocking to me to see how I show up in relationships, you know, and how dishonest I am in relationships and how selfish I could be in relationships. And, you know, like he just said, you know, it wasn't like my old man ever sat me down and, you know, we had a discussion on the birds and the bees and how do you do relationships. Everything I ever learned about a relationship was from the older guys in the bar, in the neighborhood, on the street corners, and how you treat women. It's that simple, right? Hostage taking, as we say, right? And to get what I want, to get sex, that's it. I don't know that. You know, I show up in AA, I hear this word intimacy, I think it's sex, you know? I have no idea it's about affection and trust and all that other stuff, right? So that was a process that, for me, took a long period of time, right? So, you know, I was married. Like I said, I got back with my wife, my ex-wife now. You know, I forget the time frame, but we stayed married for about 18 years. But around year 10, like I shared last night, you know, I got a little bit of attention in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went through the process of 5.5 steps, thinking I had a spiritual awakening. Did a few amends here and there. Lame prayer life, lame meditation life. Wrote nighttime inventory once in a blue moon. Try to help as many guys as I can. I don't know what I passed on. Not much, probably, but, you know, I was trying to be a person in AA, you know. But I had my secrets. I had secrets. And I'm not going to tell anyone about my secrets, you know. I'm a classic double life guy, you know. I'm going to talk about just so much that you like me, but not enough that you hate me, right? So, you know, I'm in this relationship, and we start to have financial problems and this problem and that problem, and, you know, through years, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of sobriety. And then, like I said last night, 10 years of sobriety, you know, I meet this girl in AA. I knew her for a long time. I knew her husband, you know. And she showed me a little of affection and hook, line, and sinker. You know, I think she touched my leg one day in a meeting, and all of a sudden I fell in love with her. And that's how I do relationships. You know, and I start this unbelievably crazy sex-fueled relationship with this woman and living that double life. Telling my sponsor about 20% of what's really going on. You know, if I lived in wherever we are now, Malibu, San Juan, I don't even know where I am. You know, I would have to go to, you know, San Diego to have a date with her because, God forbid, I run into someone on this side of town that knows me, right? Because I want to go to your meetings and tell you how spiritually centered I am, and I want to talk about the steps, and I'm a guru, and I know all these things. But God forbid you see the double life I'm living. And so I'm with this woman, and, you know, there's a lot of things revealed to me. I mean, Tommy talked about the gift of inventory. I couldn't see this stuff unless I got it out of here and got it on paper eventually. But at 10 years of sobriety, you know, when I just had back surgery. I just had my first back surgery. They took 5 discs out of my lower back. Old school fusion, put a cinder block in my back, sewed me up. I'm walking around AA with a walker for 2.5 years. Like I said, I had 3 knee replacements. I'm a physical mess, but I guess she thought I was hot. But I jump in his relationship with this girl, and it goes south real fast. Because I'm a deviant. I'm just looking out for me. I just want what I want. I don't know how to bring anything into a relationship. And I don't want to claim ignorance. I probably know to be an honest guy would really be helpful. Or be a trustworthy guy would really, or a faithful guy. That would be really helpful, but I don't want to do that. Because I want what I want when I want it. And I want to do things to pleasure me, right? And I don't care if I'm hurting you either. I have no self-regard for anyone. It's like embarrassing to even tell you that. But that's who I've become, right? And so I'm in this relationship with her, and it's crazy. It's sex-fueled. She has a husband that's in the other room with brain cancer dying, and I'm screwing her in the other room. Total disregard for this gentleman. And I'm sure she was running from her problems too, but I didn't see it that way. I just think she loves me. We're going to fall in love. We're going to move on. Everything's going to be wonderful. And I have this back surgery, and I'm in a garage one day, and she said something to me. I said something to her. She said something to me, and I said something like this. I'm going to break your goddamn neck. That's who I am when I deal with stuff. I'm going to break your goddamn neck. And I walk away, and I go to where most 45-year-old men live with their mother. And I went to my mother's house, and I'm there, and get a bang on the door about 11 o'clock at night. And there's 3 sheriffs at my door. And they got a restraining order on me that, you know, from this woman. And I'm like, restraining? What's a, you know, what'd I do? The old, what'd I do, you know? But I got a restraining order. And I got to go to court on this restraining order. And so I get a suit on and I go to court and, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I learned my lesson. I'm an asshole and I'm angry and I should probably talk to my sponsor about this stuff and write inventory on this stuff. And, yeah, I've learned my lesson again, you know. It's the same old inventory, just not written out yet. You know, the same guy that was with his first girlfriend at, you know, 15 years old is acting the same way, you know, 30 years later, 20 years or whatever it is, time later. And I'm in the courtroom and I'm sitting over here like David's sitting over here, and she walks in with a guy with a suit on, and I right away I'm pretty smart. I said, that must be a lawyer. She has a lawyer with her. And I'm like, why'd she bring a lawyer to this for? And then all of a sudden they call our names. We go in the courtroom, and the lawyer and this woman ripped me up like you wouldn't believe. And I have really no self-defense. Everything they're saying is true about the way I'm acting. This woman was beautiful. She was 6 foot tall. She was a Texan. She had the accent. That really helped. Blonde. She looked like a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader. And I'm standing there and I'm fuming because of the things they're saying about me. Because I know what they're saying about me is true, even though I want to deny that feeling. And all of a sudden, the judge stands up like I'm standing up here, and he has the robe on. And he picks up a red Sharpie. Now, I got PTSD from red Sharpies, and this is why. He picks up a New Jersey meeting book, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting book, and he starts to circle meetings that I'm banned from because of my behavior. Who gets banned from AA? I do. That's who gets banned from AA. And I don't go to these meetings because she goes to those meetings. And the fuel is on, the fuel is lit. I want to kill this woman. I want to kill this woman because of my pride, my selfishness, my all that stuff. You know, how it affects me, the victim. I'm 13 years sober. And that's when I walked in that bar that day I told you about, because I'm lying to everyone. You see, it's so, you can only hold your breath so long in here, living that kind of life, that double life that we live in here. And I wanted to drink that day, but I don't drink. And that's when I met Peter, and that's when I started to go through the process, and I started to go through inventory again. And I started to peel the onion back a little bit more deeper on why I am the way I am in relationships, and why I act the way I act in relationships. And, you know, I had to write inventory on this woman. I hated her. I resented her. I was pissed at her, you know? And so I started to write that, you know, first column. If you're familiar with the four column, if Howard was here, it'd be a three column. That'd be another five-hour discussion. But column one, her name, boom. Column two, here's all the reasons. Restraining order, boom, 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 all the way down, right? Column three, it affects my, right? We all look at that. My security, my pocketbook, my ambitions, my, you know, all the language, right? And I start to see a little bit about Jimmy, that I play the role of the victim all the time when things don't go my way. That I blame others all the time when things don't go my way. And I see a little light in there that maybe I might be a little bit of a problem, sometimes in relationships. But I can't see the truth. When you start writing the inventory, when you start reading the inventory, what it says is that we need to be thorough and honest, thorough and honest in this process of writing inventory, right? And one thing I found out really quick, it's really hard to be honest when you got to be right. Because I need to be right. I need to not let you know that I'm a loser because I'm an AA guru. I'm 13 years sober. I'm 14 years sober. But I start to write this inventory. And a few things start to come out. I just want to pull this thing up because the way I write it, sexual inventory, you know, I would look at, you know, the way I was taught, you know, along with the nine questions is, you know, I would have to write this little setting a table sheet, you know, like write a little brief history of the relationship, you know, a couple of questions like, what were my motives for getting involved with this relationship? Other than the obvious, great sex, beautiful looking woman. But what were my motives for jumping? Why did I jump into this relationship with this woman? Well, one, I lost all intimacy with my ex-wife. Like we were boyfriend, girlfriend. I put this woman through the ringer, my first wife. I put her through the ringer. I got a soccer story like Bill does. Driven by old ideas, I'll never forget. When I got divorced, I was at a soccer field. There was about 3,000 people. It was like 10 fields. There was a huge tournament in my state going on. My ex-wife walked up to me. She said, I need some money. Now, I'm paying alimony. I'm paying child support. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. But for some reason, I short-circuited in my mind when she said, I need some money, because I'm giving her everything I got. And before you know it, you know what I'm doing at a soccer field in front of 3,000 people and all these adults? I'm choking my ex-wife in the middle of a field. Choking her. This woman ran up to me. She goes, get your hands off her. And I'm like in my head saying, when I'm done with her, I'm getting you. I mean, that's how out of my mind I was with anger and rage. How did this happen? And finally, I snapped out of it. I let go. My kids are crying. Daddy, let go, daddy. I start to walk towards my car, and I'm just waiting for the tackle. I'm waiting for the police to just nail me. And they never did. And at that time, I was dating my now wife. I get to the car. I call her up. You're not going to believe what happened. And she thought I was going to tell her a little funny story, a little funny joke. I told her what happened. It was dead silence. this is what I go out with, an animal. Men, this is how I do relationships. So I'm writing this inventory. You can't see the truth about it. There's a really important line in the inventory process is that, and I'll paraphrase it because I'm a little all over the place here, but, you know, as we see, you know, we see others as, you know, when we get home, we see, you know, they're spiritually sick just like me. I'm starting to write inventory, and I'm starting to look at her part, or not her part, I'm just looking at this relationship as a whole, and I'm thinking, man, I'm just as sick as her. I do things just as crazy as her. I start to see that I'm playing the role of the victim on this thing, that I'm holding out, that I'm living in this third column, you know, where ego and judgment live free room and free board, because I want to blame her for everything that's going on in my life. But the truth of the matter is, it's all me. And as I start to go into that fourth inventory or that fourth step, I start to see the resentment. But more importantly, as I'm writing the sex inventory, you know, I see that I'm using this woman for money, because when her husband died, she cashed in on about a $500,000 life insurance policy. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm a piece of garbage. I have a tremendous amount of shame, guilt, and remorse of what I did walking out on a family. Most alkies have shame-based identities. I got shame for everything. Shame of not being a good son, good husband, good dad. You know, from here to the back wall, I got a list of things that I'm shameful about. And one of the things I'm shameful about is walking out on those little kids and just letting them flat. I'm a real good dad, I'll tell you, though. I'll come to your meeting and tell you about what a great dad I am. But the truth of the matter is, I'm not a good father. Not then. And so, you know, I'm... writing this inventory, and it suggests that, you know, when you get to that fourth column, you start looking at your part, you know, your mistakes, your shortcomings, your wrongs, all that stuff, and I see the truth about that stuff. I see how dishonest and selfish I am in that. And yeah, even though I knew that through the resentment inventory I had with the woman, it was more about the inventory about the sex relations. I started to see how I was using this woman for money, for sex, for just to get me out of, I was using this woman like a drink. She was a drink with two legs. That's all she was. And as I went through those questions and I started to see some of the things, you know, one of the things they ask in here, and you know, how am I being selfish? I had to start asking myself, am I an equal partner in any relationship I've ever been in? You know? Am I only concerned with my own needs, my own wants, my own beliefs? I started to see selfishness on a different level that I never saw before. Where have I been dishonest? I've been dishonest in every relationship, not only out and out lies, half truths, sins of omission, all that kind of stuff. How about manipulation? How have I used manipulation in my life when it comes to relationships? Where have I been inconsiderate? What I feel, what I believe, what I do is more important than what anyone in my life ever felt, believed, or did. It's always been about Jimmy. And then I wonder why I don't have healthy relationships like Tom and Cheryl, or Bill and Karen, or anyone else that has good, healthy relationships in here. You know, I always judge me against you, and I always fall short because I know the truth. But as I go on with this thing, you know, I start to look at, you know, who am I hurt? That's real easy. Do I arouse jealousy? Am I flirting with my partner present, you know? Am I still showing attention to others with my partner present? You know, am I at that side of the room, and all of a sudden I'm flirting with her, and my wife's over there? I mean, these are the things I was doing. Total disregard for anyone else in my life. Did I arouse bitterness? Am I sarcastic to my wife? Or anyone in my relationship? I've always been a sarcastic son of a bitch. So I write this inventory out, and I see this woman for what she is and for what I am. In the inventory process, it says, you know, we have that sick man prayer. Save me from being angry. How can I be helpful? And I just can't let go of my anger towards this woman because of what she did. And it suggested to me, someone said to me, Jimmy, why don't you go into the back of the book? There's a story, Freedom from Bondage, on page 551. Now, a lot of people don't believe in this story. They don't think it's helpful. But if you know that story, this woman from out here, I think California, she wrote it about how she got free of her resentment and how she was able to let go of one against the mother. And she tells that story of picking up a magazine at a hospital one day, and on the top of the magazine it said resentment. And it was in some instruction in that that said, if you have a resentment against someone, start praying for them. And I know a lot of people say, oh, that doesn't work, that story. I had nothing to lose. I couldn't let go of this anger I had. I couldn't let go of this rage I had inside of me. What do I have to lose? This woman in the story says, for 2 weeks, if you do this thing for 2 weeks, pray for somebody else, the resentment will be lifted. Didn't happen for me in 2 weeks. But every day I got up and I started to pray for this woman. I prayed that she would get everything in her life that I wanted in my life. Good relationships, good health, sobriety, on and on and on. And 2 weeks passed, nothing happened. 2 months passed, nothing happened. 6 months, I woke up one day and I said the prayer, and all of a sudden I felt a shift in consciousness. I felt a shift in my heart, and I understood. And on that day, I became willing to go make amends to this woman for my behavior and what the things I did to her. But there's a problem. This woman moved back down to Dallas, Texas. And with 28 years of sobriety, she hung herself. And she wrote a suicide note, and I just want to show you the level of selfishness inside of me. It's 17 years later, and I think she's writing that suicide note about me. That's how crazy I am. It wasn't about me. But I was willing to make amends. The problem is, I don't know where this woman lived or is buried. And I found out eventually that she was buried with her husband in Iowa. And my only unfinished amends. I'm not going to Iowa. How am I going to get to Iowa? I don't even know where in Iowa. But I'm willing. And once in a while, I look her name up in Google. Nothing. Then last year, I went to a men's retreat like this. I substituted for him because he got sick. See, God's got a plan going on right now. God is starting to connect the dots, but I don't see it connecting the dots until after the fact. He gets sick, and about 2 days before the retreat, the guy calls me who's running the retreat, goes, Tommy's sick, can you fill in? I was supposed to do it a couple of weeks with his sponsor. So we flip-flop. Tommy's doing it this year, and I go and I do it with Joe Krogan. And we're talking about this, relationships and sex. And I'm telling the same story that I'm telling you guys about Iowa. When after the meeting, a guy comes up to me, goes, hey, would you be willing to come to Iowa and do a retreat? I said, really? And in between this, I Googled this woman's name before this. And a new website, maybe it's not new, maybe I just never saw it, called Find a Grave, pops up. And her name is in there when I put her name in. Not only the cemetery, not only what row she's buried in, not only what head plot lot block number, or whatever you call that, I got all that information on my phone right now. And I say to the guy, you know, let me ask you a question. Thank you for asking me to come to Iowa, but do you know where Clarion, Iowa is? He goes, yeah, that's about 20 minutes down the road from where you'll be speaking. God has no plans, yeah? So next July, I'll be in Clarion, Iowa, making amends, or trying to make amends to a headstone, to a woman that I destroyed with my behavior. Not that I drove her to suicide, obviously, but just another woman that's been in my path, because I'm a tornado when it comes to relationships. So I'm not real good. My wife, Mary Beth, I knew her for a long time. I knew her when I was married. I knew her when I was with this woman. We were kind of friendly, you know. She was from North Jersey. I knew her family. Her family, Pete met him. It was Pete right there. Big basketball family. My dad was a pretty famous basketball player. Played in the NBA, all that stuff. And she used to be a great member for a home group in New York City in the middle of the World Trade Center called the Tower Group. There was a meeting every day in the World Trade Center in the towers at 12:15. I think it was Tower 7 or Tower 4, 7th floor, 4th floor. I always forget what that was. And she would invite guys like us to come over, do a 15, 20-minute pitch, speak a discussion-type meeting. So I used to go over there, cup of coffee, turned into, you know, lunch, turned into a proposal, and we just celebrated 20 years of marriage. And when the World Trade Center came down, a lot of her members in her group died. You know, and I remember going to some of those memorials with people in AA. You know, so I start this relationship, or I start this marriage with Mary Beth. Quite different. Because I was willing to invest in our relationship. I was willing to look at a relationship like I've never looked at before. You know, having a sex ideal. That was one of the first things my sponsor told me. He said, I want you to write an inventory on this relationship and what are you going to bring to this relationship? And let's have an ideal of this relationship ideal. And put it in prayer form and let me read and read it to me when you get it done. So I write a prayer. Dear God, as I understand, as I inventory my sex instincts in the past, today, and in the future, I have found that I have fallen short. I pray for the strength to practice honesty, unselfishness, thoughtfulness, and consideration. I pray that you help me mold these ideals and help me to live up to them. Father, I pray to see the truth in all my relationships, and if I fail, I pray for the willingness to admit my faults and the strength to do the right thing. Lord, I pray that you direct my relationships rather than fear. Every relationship I've ever been until now has been based on fear. And I needed to see truth. You know, it might surprise you if I tell you this, but this is my truth. I've never had a fight with my wife in 21 years. Never. Disagreements? Yep. But a fight? Nope. No punching walls, no screaming, no intimidation. No standing over nor belittle it in any way. My home has become a safe house for me and her. My home is a place where she, who is now 29 years sober, takes care of herself with sponsorship, sponsoring others, working the steps, having a prayer life, having a meditation life. And I try to do the same exact thing with my life. One of the reasons I went to Baba's Aunts as a sponsor after going with Peter for 17 years was the attraction of him and Linda, for those who know Bob and Linda, who just celebrated 58 years of, you know, marriage. Bob's sober 58 years, Linda's 58 years in Al-Anon. That doesn't mean they don't have problems, but they live their life on the life that I want to live, which is the spiritual principles. Because I never brought spiritual principles into relationships. Never brought intimacy into a relationship. And like Tommy just said, it's all about sex. Getting what I want, when I want, when I want it. So, you know, I was coaching girls basketball one day, and just to show you how things could heal, I went back to that ex-wife of mine. I tried to make amends, and she said, go kill yourself, basically. I hate your guts. And I had to accept that. But I made every alimony payment. I paid child support. I paid my kids' colleges off. I did all the things that I was supposed to do. And the greatest thing that happened to me was... the worst thing that happened to me became the greatest thing that ever happened to me, getting in that accident. Poor me, poor me. I thought when I got in that accident, man, my life was over. But guess what? God had other plans, because what happened to me was I was able to be in my kids' lives more on a full-time basis than, you know, that every other weekend dad and every Wednesday night dad. I never missed a baseball game, a basketball game, a swim meet, you name it. I was at every event where you guys had to work all day. I was at my kids' games. And I was showing up. And my ex-wife saw that I was showing up. And somewhere along the lines, that relationship, that ice started to melt too. And all of a sudden, she trusted me. And all of a sudden, you know, she meets my new wife. I'm coaching girls basketball. The intensity of the game is going back and forth, back and forth. And God grabs me by the back of the head and says, hey, look in the stands. And I look in the stands, it's my ex-wife with my wife and my mother. And I wonder what they're talking about. I'm proud to announce it wasn't about me. The family has healed. And that's what happens here in relationships. We heal. But we have to get honest. Me and my ex-wife walked my daughter down the aisle when she got married. My son just got married about a month ago. He did it a little bit backwards. He had the kid, bought the house, and then got married. But it's you young guys are different. When my daughter-in-law had the baby shower, This is kind of weird, but not that weird, but I couldn't touch my ex-wife for some reason. I don't know how you're hearing that right now. I just couldn't. There was no hugs or anything like that. Hey, Chris, how you doing? Hey, Jim, how you doing? That was it. When my daughter-in-law had a baby shower, we were in a restaurant, like a room about this size. And I helped a lot, and I got all the guys, and we were taking all the gifts back to the house. And she walked up to me, and I don't know, I put my arms around her, my ex-wife. And I gave her a big hug, and I said, you've done real good as a mom. You really raised these kids, like, unbelievably. Couldn't see that. She gave me a hug back. And now when we see each other, it's like, and her, it's a little weird. My ex-wife and my wife are very close now. It's bizarre, really. But I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm getting old. I am old. I don't want any unresolved issues in my life anymore. I want to, like, go out kind of peacefully in somewhat fashion. And I don't know when that's going to be. It could be this week, could be next year, could be 25 years from now. I want to heal. I want to be a better man. That's really what we're here for, right? Iron sharpens iron. I see his relationship. I want what he has, right? And yeah, you're in a, you know, we were out to the dinner the other night, and I said, you ever notice, like, sometimes you're in a receiving line at a conference, and a pretty nice woman walks up to you, and maybe I'm old and I don't get it. Maybe, do you ever get flirted on? He goes, yeah, that happens once in a while. And that's the kind of stuff that I would fall for hook, line, and sinker. Right? I'm committed to a relationship. I'm committed to a wife. I love my wife. I love the life I've been given because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of God, having people like you in my life. But don't let me fool you. This takes work. This takes effort. You know, this takes patience. This takes love and tolerance. You know, this isn't easy, you know, especially for guys like us or a guy like me. You know, I've had to put work into my relationships to have it what it is today. So I think that's all I have. And I guess lunch is next at 12, right?
We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions. Toll free 1-877-893-2777 or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.